The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me tonight. Alfred P. Sloan was a longtime CEO of General Motors and is credited by many for having created the field of modern management education. In 1934, he also created a foundation that bears his name. And this evening, you will hear from the man charged with carrying on that legacy. He is Adam Falk, the president of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
So at the Sloan Foundation, we support science and economics. And that means supporting research in science and economics done by scholars, but also supporting people, the young people who do that work, graduate students and young faculty. We support the diversity of those fields, and we support tools that people use to do that work, as well as the public understanding of that work.
And there are few diseases that are any more feared than Alzheimer's disease. And we will be discussing it, the causes, the symptoms, the research, and much more with Harry Johns, the president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association.
At this point, we estimate there are about 50 million people worldwide who have dementia because of some cause, and that all of these numbers in the United States and worldwide are set to basically triple by mid-century. And that's, of course, if we can't correct the situation. I believe we can. Mm-hmm. I believe we will.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, November 11th. A survey found that 93% of people who said they drive on a regular basis are willing to travel up to 50 miles to volunteer. And 28% said they were willing to have their volunteer work directly relate to driving, such as taking people places they need to go. The Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation will direct $85 million over the next 6 years to help doctors and hospitals minimize diagnostic errors. Inaccurate explanations for patients' health problems cause at least 40,000 deaths a year and are the most common cause of medical errors identified by patients. And finally, a year after the Boy Scouts of America announced it would admit girls, the Girl Scouts of the United States of America punch back this week with a federal trademark lawsuit seeking to block the boys' group from rebranding its flagship program simply as Scout. And that is a Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Adam Falk of the Sloan Foundation right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Learn more by visiting benetech.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center is one of the most highly regarded institutions of its kind in the world, as is the Sloan School of Management, that being the business school at MIT. In both cases, the Sloan refers to Alfred P. Sloan, who also founded a foundation that bears his name back in 1934. And here to tell us about it and all the work that they do is Adam Falk, the president of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Good evening, Adam, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Adam, tell us about the mission of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
So at the Sloan Foundation, we support science and economics. And that means supporting research in science and economics done by scholars, but also supporting people, the young people who do that work, graduate students and young faculty. We support the diversity of those fields, and we support tools that people use to do that work, as well as the public understanding of that work.
You know, before we get into that work at the foundation, who was Alfred P. Sloan, and what is he remembered for?
So Alfred P. Sloan built the modern General Motors. So if you think of General Motors as that company that has divisions, Pontiac and Oldsmobile and Chevrolet, that kind of corporation was invented by Alfred P. Sloan. And he ran General Motors for about 25 years, from the 30s to the 50s, and made it the dominant company in American business. And had a fortune. and decided he was going to use that fortune for the public good.
Yeah. And he was the guy who came up with the idea of a new model of car every year.
A new model of car every year and segmented divisions so that every division was aimed at a particular part of the consumer landscape at different price points, different luxury points. So he created constant desire for the products of the company.
Yeah, that's really brilliant because, I mean, he was not competing against himself then. They were sort of like these ladders or these gradients that you would go up based on your income and your success.
That's exactly right. And so you would always need a new and a different car.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have such an interesting portfolio of the things that you're involved with. I'm going to touch on just a few to give listeners a taste of the breadth and scope of it all. There has been significant grant making directed towards environmental issues, but not so much to the indoor environment. But Sloan has made a 10-year commitment to understanding the chemistry of built spaces. That's so interesting. Share with us what you're doing here and what you're finding out.
Yeah. So our chemistry of the indoor environment program actually follows a program in the molecular biology of the indoor environment. So if I start with that one, it starts with the observation that the bugs, the microbiome that's in this room is actually very different from what you would find out in the wild. Because we're here, because of the different ways the surfaces that those bugs live on. And if we want to understand our health and the things that are going on here, we have to do a different kind of biology. So we built over 10 years a field of indoor microbiology, which is now a flourishing field. So coming out of that, we decided it was also important to understand the chemistry of what goes on inside rooms, inside houses. And again, if you want to think about why that's different from outdoor atmospheric chemistry, outdoors, the atmosphere is big, and it's mostly lots of air flowing around.
Mm-hmm.
In here, it's surfaces, right? The indoors, it's all surfaces, and it's all the chemicals that you and I bring in. So that's partly the stuff that comes out of our bodies, but it's a lot of it the stuff that we slather on our bodies. And so the kinds of chemical reactions, the kinds of chemicals that are important to the environment in which we're living are very different indoors. And there's required a whole different set of tools and adaptations of instruments to do that work indoors. And that's what we're supporting now. We've been doing it for a few years and we're going to do it for about a decade. And we're hoping to build a whole field of indoor chemistry.
Fantastic. What I have always known Sloan the best for is the Sloan Research Fellowship Program. That is your signature science program. You were one yourself, as a matter of fact. And it's also an on-ramp for many future Nobel Prize winners. Tell us about it and share some of its rich history.
So this goes back all the way to the 50s, and Sloan felt strongly that to support science and economics, you had to support young people, and they were the future, and you had to support them in ways which gave them flexibility around what they were going to do. So for decades now, we've given about 100 of these Sloan Research Fellowships in a number of fields to people not long after their PhD, before they get tenure,
okay,
when they're still building their research programs. And we've had almost 50 of our former Sloan Research Fellows win Nobel Prizes. This year, one of the economics prizes, Nobel Prizes, went to a former Sloan Research Fellow, and one of the prizes in physics went to one. And she was actually only the third woman to win the Nobel Prize in physics. It was absolutely terrific.
What did she win it for?
She won it, along with her advisor, for inventing ways of making very fast laser pulses, which turned out to be really important if you're interested in studying the dynamics of things that are happening really fast. So it was an incredibly important tool. She did it about 30 years ago. So as a former Sloan Research Fellow, I can tell you that a little bit of money, and it's about, now that prize is about $70,000, that can make an enormous difference early in somebody's career as they're trying to build their career and get tenure. And the foundation's had a wonderful record of supporting the right people.
Yeah, along with the prestige of winning it. It's going to help
your career
as well.
That really helps on your tenure packet when you say you've won a Sloan Research Fellowship.
I bet it does. You know, another major area of focus for the foundation is economics. And to this day, the foundation remains the largest single private funder of economic research. And I guess that's kind of built into your DNA, having been found in 1934 around the Depression. I mean, that was central in everybody's mind. A lot of this work is on behavioral economics and choice architecture and decision-making by individuals and households. Tell us a little bit about that work.
Yeah. So the foundation's been supporting behavioral economics since the late 80s, really since the birth of the field.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an example of what we like to do when we're really being – when the thing that we like to do the most, which is to come into a new field in which techniques from one field may be entering another, in this case, techniques taken from psychology entering economics, where maybe people aren't supported yet because nobody quite knows what to make of that field, but we get in there early and support people. And so behavioral economics is now an enormous field.
Yeah.
It's very popular. A lot of people working on it. We still support it. But I think our greatest contribution was to be there at the beginning when nobody was supporting it. And I think that that's one of the things you can do as a foundation is you have a flexibility to make a bet on something that seems like a really great idea. I think the most impactful thing we've done in behavioral economics was when the Obama White House set up a unit to think about behavioral nudges to help people make good choices around federal programs. That was a Sloan-supported fellow who went into the Obama White House to set up that office. And they did a lot of really, really great work that really has made people's lives better.
Yeah, yeah. And it would also seem that the breadth of everything you do gives you wonderful peripheral vision in terms of working on something and being inspired to work on something in a completely different field, which a lot of single-focused foundations don't have that ability.
There's an enormous amount of crosstalk, as it were, between our programs. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about the digital technology program at some point. But let me mention something, which is another thing we support in economics is what we call administrative data research centers. And that sounds like a really boring, long word. But what it really means is it's all sorts of data that is collected by companies or by the government that is public data, but not organized in a way that people can make good use research use of it. So we've been funding centers which collect this data, and this is, again, public data, not private data, and organize it and make it available. That's an economics project, but it's also a digital technologies project. And so the people who work on digital technologies at the foundation are collaborating in this grant making with the people who support economics. And we do a lot of that collaboration across the foundation, and it's some of the most exciting stuff we do.
Well, I'm glad you don't have those silos. I'll tell you something that isn't boring to me is your Working Longer program for those who need to or want to work beyond the convention. Retirement age. What are some of the things that I should know, Adam?
Well, one of the things you should know is one of the best economic choices you can make is to delay your retirement as long as possible. What we're particularly interested in that program is the effect on people of working longer. That is, this again came out of an earlier program on workplace flexibility that we supported for more than a decade, and trying to help companies and people understand the needs of modern workers and the ways in which giving them more flexibility would make their lives better, but also make workplaces more productive. And so similarly with working longer, we're trying to understand what it's like for people. What are the needs that people have if they're going to work longer, let's say well into their 60s? And also, how can that benefit companies? Take that expertise that people have and continue to benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
So just raising the profile of that, doing research on what's happening, giving people the tools they need to make good policy, although not advocating for that policy ourselves, that's our niche there.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about science, technology, and economics, but you're also dedicated to the public understanding of those areas. And boy, this is a multifaceted program with film and radio and new media and TV. What have been some of your more successful ventures here?
So our theory of change, as it were, around public understanding is that as much as it's important to support really great documentaries, to help people really understand the importance of science, you have to go far beyond that. So I'm a scientist, and the weakness that we scientists have is that when we explain something and we don't think it's been understood, we think the solution would be to explain it some more.
Maybe a little louder.
A little louder with more diagrams. And of course, it's really silly. Often what people need is to understand science as something that is close to them, that's done by people that they can relate to, people that they might not have expected to be scientists and that they're going to trust. So very recently, for example, we've supported a documentary about Hedy Lamarr.
Mm.
So Hedy Lamarr, you can see that. I think it's on television.
She's a brilliant woman.
She was a brilliant woman, and she was the most beautiful movie star of her day, but she was an inventor.
Mm-hmm.
And she made significant contributions during the war to technology, something called frequency hopping, which is now essential to all cell phone technology.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think of an inventor, you don't think of Hedy Lamarr. But in fact, that she was, as a woman at a time when it was hard as a woman to be supported and recognized for the work you do, as a movie star when nobody expected that of her, she she was incredibly important for the technologies we have today. So we want people to think about that. Hidden Figures is an incredible movie. We supported Margot Shetterly in finishing that book. And again, that's a book that's a story that's about how do you get to the moon and what math do you need? What's the science of getting to the moon? But it's also a different story about who got us there. So I think the best things that we do in our public understanding program are simultaneously teaching people facts about science and technology, but also broadening their sense of who does science and technology and making them comfortable with the communities of us scientists.
Right. Well, at your heart, you have to be a storyteller.
Yeah, it's a storyteller. It's all storytelling.
It sure is. Well, let's pick up on what you talked about before, digital information technology. And there's so many tremendous opportunities with the internet and computing technology. One of those areas that I thought was interesting was scholarly communications, which you're really enabling scientists to work together better and to share research. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is part of a program where we want to invest in tools that make science better. And one of them is the investing in ways in which scientists can share information broadly. So some of what we do is invest in software that scientists use to collaborate. And then one of the things we're really interested in is investing in other ways that they disseminate their what they have discovered. So to give you an example of that, a lot of the work that scientists do takes a long time to come out in journals. And they've come to, they would like to distribute it earlier and via preprint servers and kind of online communications. And we've made grants to help scientists do that well. That leads to, for example, better collaboration, and it leads to better reproducibility of research if people can share and collaborate earlier, but also can share their work at an earlier stage. So these are tools that are hard to support outside the foundation world.
Right.
They're not there aren't enough users that the commercial kind of world can really support that. Government funding agencies often don't want to support that. And so there's a niche for foundations can come in, and there's a great leverage in making the work of scientists better with just some relatively modest investments in these things.
You've also made some investments in the universal access to knowledge. What have some of those been?
Well, the one that we're the most excited about is for a long time, early on and for a long time, we've been a supporter of Wikipedia. And that is, I think, as good an example as one can find about a free resource that is supported by foundations and by individual gifts that has broadened the ability to know about all sorts of things for anyone in the world on their phone. It's an astonishing fact of the world that you can pick up your phone and through Wikipedia get a very good information on almost anything. And the idea that Wikipedia is kind of schlocky and isn't to be trusted, that's entirely wrong, actually.
Yeah.
It's one of the most reliable sources of information that there is because it's crowdsourced and because everyone's contributing to it. And doing that in a way that I have to say is civil and is respectful and where facts matter.
Hard to believe if you had to make a bet 20 years ago, Wikipedia or Encyclopedia Britannica, which one would make it and which one would die? And I think a lot of us would have had that one wrong.
We would have had it wrong. And I think the thing that Wikipedia has going for it is its infinite expandability and it updatability.
Yeah.
You bought those inside. We all had those encyclopedias on our shelves when we were kids, and they were frozen in time.
Static.
And they give you a little book every year. You buy the update. But at the end of the day, they were really static, and the world is moving just too fast.
One last thing I want to ask you about digital, and this is your longest-running science program, and that would be the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Right. What's that about?
So this is one that's a real favorite of mine. And we started supporting this collaboration in astronomy back in the 90s. So let me tell you a little bit about it. For the longest time, for centuries, what astronomy meant was taking a big piece of glass, a mirror, and a camera, and pointing it at the sky, object by object, and looking really hard at that galaxy or that nebula or that planet, and learning as much about it, and then moving on to the next one. What was realized in the early 1990s was that with the invention of computerized cameras, CCD cameras, which are now everywhere, and the ability to store and analyze terabytes of data, you could do a totally different kind of astronomy. And this is an astronomy where you survey the sky and you look, you measure everything, but just a little bit about everything instead of a lot about a few things. Millions of galaxies, in a single year. We're measured the spectra that is the what the light looked like, and you can do a completely different kind of science with that. And it has transformed the way that people do astronomy. A lot of the cosmology, our understanding of the birth of the early universe and dark energy, that comes from these kinds of surveys. So that's been running for 20 years. Mm-hmm. We've just renewed it for another 5.
Great.
There's a telescope is in New Mexico and one is in Chile. And I think it's very important that I go visit the one in Chile. And I should say it's also transformed the way people do astronomy, because this is done in a big collaboration. Mm-hmm. And astronomers had to learn how to collaborate. And now this is how they do that. And finally, they release the data to the public.
Yeah.
So if you go on to SDSS, Sloan Digital Sky Survey's website.
Open source.
It's open source. You can find the data. 4 out of every 5 papers that are written with the data from the Sky Survey are written by people who are not part of that collaboration, but are people who went online and used the data themselves.
That's how we make progress.
So it's how we make progress, and I just love that project.
One last thing I want to ask you about your program, and that is your support of underrepresented minority students in something you call the MPhD program. Right. Tell us about that.
So I think there's a question that every institution that wants to make the world better, and certainly the Sloan Foundation is one, and colleges and universities, and has to be thoughtful about in this day and age. And that is, how are we going to participate in increasing the diversity and inclusion of those fields that we care about?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that is a fundamental question for our society. It's a fundamental question for every institution that works within our society. And so at the foundation, we take that very, very seriously as absolutely core to what we do. And it takes a number of forms. I mean, the first is the one that you mentioned, that our niche there is graduate education. And so we make grants to institutions, long-term grants that are designed not just to support individual students, but to change culture, to make graduate programs in science more diverse and more inclusive, to think not just about who comes in the door, but how you support people of color and women in fields in which they are underrepresented. Because the future of science and engineering depends on this.
No question.
And the second thing that we do is every single grant that you get, I don't care what that grant is in, if you get a grant from the Sloan Foundation, you need to be thoughtful about and prove to us that you're being thoughtful about how that contributes to diversity and inclusion. If you're holding a conference, we want to know, what does the speaker list look like? Mm-hmm. And who are you inviting? If you have a postdoctoral program, well, who have you had as your postdocs? Who are your graduate students? In our public understanding program, how are you telling the stories of scientists who aren't just white men?
Mm-hmm.
And I think by keeping that central focus as a piece of everything we do, we can change the conversation about these issues in science and engineering and mathematics and economics, and we're deeply committed to that.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things foundations can do, because they're in a position to have that kind of leverage, and that's how we change the field, and that's how we change our thinking. The foundation is dealing at the very highest levels in the fields of science, technology, engineering, math, economics. And the U.S. has held a preeminent position in those fields for quite a few decades now. With the advances by other nations around the world, the Chinas, the Indias, the others, how do you believe we're stacking up today?
I mean, I don't think there's any question that at this moment, the United States is still the engine of innovation around the world. I think we are in that position because we, over the decades, have attracted people from the brightest people from all over the world. It's like we've hoovered them up out of all the corners of the globe and brought them here and kept them here. And if you look at the great companies in this country, many of them were founded by immigrants. The most important thing we can do to retain our preeminence in leadership around innovation is to continue to support the immigration of bright young people from around the world. And that includes just young people who are students, not mm-hmm. just people who are already professionals. We need to make this an attractive country to come to. And if we are an attractive country to come to where people feel welcome to immigrate, the brightest people in the world will come here and we will continue to lead the world. And the greatest threat is that we stop doing that. Mm-hmm. And if we stop doing that, we're not going to be leaders anymore. I'm certain of that.
Adam, you were the president of Williams College, a marvelous institution, for the 8 years or so before you took on this position. How has that transition been? I'm sure some of it's been great. Some of it's been difficult. Tell us about it.
Well, it's been a wonderful transition, and I loved being the president of Williams. And before that, I was the dean of arts and sciences at Johns Hopkins, and I loved that. I think that this is a different way of using a resource to make change and to make the world better. And in many ways, I support many of the same people. I support many of the same faculty as the president of the Sloan Foundation that I did when I was the dean at Johns Hopkins, the same researchers doing many of the same things, but from a different place. So I'm learning the ways in which foundations can operate differently than the deans and presidents, much more flexibility, much more kind of discretion to make decisions. And with that comes much more responsibility to be really careful about the decisions one makes. I will tell you that I miss being around students. Yeah. I've been in higher education my entire life, my entire professional life. And before that, as a student, I was in higher education. And there's an energy that students bring. And even at their most complex, and even when they're saying things that make the president unhappy, there's a wonderful energy. They are the future. And so one of the things that I love doing is we can still support graduate students as part of the work we do at Sloan Foundation. But I miss being around those kids.
Yeah, yeah. I can see you have a few gray hairs from that.
I was 6'4" and had a full head of hair when I started that job.
You know, some of the keenest observations about a field can come from those who are not steeped in it. And as I mentioned, your background is primarily academia, Williams and Johns Hopkins and some other places. So although you were tangentially connected to the foundation world, you were not part of it. But now you are. You're in this space, albeit for less than a year. What have you noticed? Has anything delighted you? Has anything been cause for concern?
I think one of the things that's the most exciting about this world, and I've met colleagues who are in foundations across the country, lead these institutions both in New York and some of the big foundations here, but also out west. Many of the exciting science foundations are out west. And one of the things that's the most exciting as I talk to these colleagues is the way in which we have a kind of flexibility to respond to needs that we perceive with more nimbleness than any other institutions that have the resources to help. And that's really exciting. And one of the things about academia is that it's very conservative and it moves slowly. And that's actually good because those are institutions that last for hundreds of years and with many constituencies. But when we see a need, we can act on it. Mm-hmm. And that gives us a responsibility and an opportunity. And so if I think about us at the foundation, we've recently invested in a project with a bunch of other foundations to make Facebook data available for researchers in a really responsible way that respects privacy, but that also helps us understand what's going on with our democracy. And we and a number of foundations pulled this together along with the Social Science Research Council in a period of a couple of months.
That's exciting.
That never could have happened in any other sector.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the ability to do that kind of work, that kind of speed and that kind of flexibility that I think is really exciting and gives us an enormous opportunity and responsibility.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would like to see the foundation sector be a little bit more bold in all that,
right,
but they can act really quickly when they put their minds to it.
I think that's right. And we can take risks.
Mm-hmm.
And we do take risks, and which means that some of the things that we fund don't work.
Yeah, right?
That's
right.
What you can't only take the risks on the things that are going to work. And we are free to take some risks.
Yeah, yeah, we need them. Describe the corporate culture of Sloan, how things get done, how people interact, what those unwritten rules are, and anything special or notable that you've observed since you've been there.
Well, so the Sloan Foundation is a wonderful place to work from the inside. It's one of the reasons that I came there. It's very academic, actually.
Hmm.
We have all these programs we talk through, and they're really led by program directors. We have 7 program directors, each of whom makes grants in their programs, shows leadership in those programs, is responsible for them, is deeply embedded in the communities of scholars and practitioners who are there funding. And then we as a group share the responsibility for all that grant making. Every grant that's made is talked through by all of the program directors together and me. So it's a very academic and kind of scholarly environment. Those 7 program directors are 6 PhDs and 1 Rhodes Scholar.
Mm.
So they're interested in ideas. We are interested in ideas. And so the work is very collaborative, very congenial. We all, and it builds that responsibility, that sense of responsibility for, as you were mentioning before, that fidelity to the original vision of Alfred P. Sloan. We hold that together, and we really enjoy the as much the engagement with each other's work as with our own.
Yeah, it sounds pretty silo-free.
It's really silo-free, and that's what allows some of that cross-pollination across the programs that we talked about.
Let me close with this, Adam. While remaining true to the traditions of the Foundation, do you have a vision for where you would like to take Sloan, initiatives you can promote and champion that will advance the institution and make it even more relevant than it already is? Yeah.
And I think that the Foundation is constantly evolving in the programs that we're supporting. And as I look forward, I'm particularly interested in deepening our commitments around diversity and inclusion and within the PhD programs, but also within academic cultures. And we're doing some exciting grant making there. I'm really interested in our science programs. We tend to support science programs for about a decade, and we have a couple of them that are ending. One of them is molecular biology of the built environment, and we also have an earth science program called the Deep Carbon Observatory.
Deep Carbon right now.
So we have an opportunity to do some new program building in science, and I'm really excited about that. The challenge is to find an area where the scale of resources that we can invest can have a real impact, and we stay away, for example, from medical research because we are dropping the bucket.
Right.
But there are always emerging areas where a Sloan program can pull something forward, can invest maybe in the interstitial areas between two fields where the most exciting work is going on. So we're looking to figure out what that's going to be over the next couple of years, and I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, still slightly orphaned, but very, very ripe.
That's exactly right.
Well, Adam Falk, the president of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Lots and lots of information on that website of yours. What is the website, and what will visitors find there?
So if you go to www.sloan.org, you'll find information about all of our programs and links to the grantees themselves if you want to know even more than that. So I welcome you to come there.
And you can sign up for a quarterly newsletter too, right?
You can sign up to hear and get news from the Foundation, absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Adam. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
It's been great. Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Recruit the best talent. Explore the untapped pool of 24 million productive Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner to help companies succeed in disability employment. Learn more at NOD.org. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving. And now back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
One of the greatest fears that people have is that of Alzheimer's disease. But as this country and the world gets older, its prevalence will only increase. There is no organization that has driven the public discussion of this disease more, nor done as much to secure public and private funding to combat it, than has the Alzheimer's Association. And it's a great pleasure to have with us this evening their president and CEO, Harry Johns. Good evening, Harry, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, good evening. It's great to be here.
Share with us some of the history of the Alzheimer's Association and the mission of the organization.
Well, the Alzheimer's Association came into being in 1980 as a result of the advancement of science, the very specific interest of our primary founder, Jerry Stone, who had an interest in research, and the interests of a number of people who were doing care across the country. They came together to form the organization and the core of our mission still today.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what causes Alzheimer's disease?
You know, we don't really know the true path. We know a lot of advances in science about the whys, but not the very specifics. We do know that age is the biggest risk factor, as it is for many other chronic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
It is not normal aging, but age is the single biggest risk factor.
You know, we hear a lot about plaques and we hear a lot about tangles. What are those and what impact do they have on the brain?
Both the plaques and the tangles were what Alzheimer himself originally identified by now 112 years ago. So it's been around in identification for a long time, but not by scientific pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
And those plaques and tangles are misfolding, misaccumulating proteins in the brain. We have those proteins, each and every one of us, but when they misfold, misaccumulate, then we get a cascade of events that ultimately lead to the progressive and degenerative effects of Alzheimer's. So it is a devastating condition as a
result.
Yeah,
sure is. Well, as you all know, sometimes people talk about Alzheimer's. Other times they talk about dementia. Sometimes they use these almost interchangeably. What is the relationship of Alzheimer's to dementia?
Alzheimer's is the most frequently occurring cause of dementia. Dementia is the condition. It can also be caused by vascular problems, vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, frontotemporal dementia. All of these are lesser in terms of the numbers of cases of dementia they cause, but they all ultimately cause what are the problems with memory, the problems with getting through everyday life that dementia is. So many people have dementia in America. We, in Alzheimer's alone, we estimate more than 5 million, probably north of 6 million today for dementia overall.
Wow. You know, I've asked a number of guests on the show this question, and that is, what is today's most underreported story? And several have responded, the aging of the world's population. I suspect you might agree with that answer. How old is the world becoming?
Well, certainly the condition today is that age is the biggest risk factor for the world, perhaps we could say. There are now going to be more people over 65 than under 5 for the first time ever in the history of the world.
That's incredible.
And it, of course, drives all kinds of issues in health, health care, and costs for governments and for individuals across the world.
You mentioned that the prevalence of Alzheimer's in the United States today is 5, 6 million. What would that number be around the world, and what do the forecasts look like over the next several decades?
At this point, we estimate there are about 50 million people worldwide who have dementia because of some cause, and that all of these numbers in the United States and worldwide are set to basically triple by mid-century. And that's, of course, if we can't correct the situation. I believe we can. Mm-hmm. I believe we will. But those kinds of effects are huge already today on economies, on individuals, and will be ever more so, of course, if we don't change that course.
Well, let's talk about economies. And sticking here in this nation, what are the costs associated with this disease now, and what are they projected to be?
In the United States alone, we estimate that the current costs for care are about $277 billion in just this year alone. That doesn't account for the cost to individuals from the care they provide in themselves. And that's up in the $230 million billion value range.
That takes you to $500 billion
right
there.
That's exactly right. So the impact is huge already today, and all that is set to follow the same path of the growth of the disease, of the condition. And that would take us to, in the U.S. alone, in the care costs, the hard costs, $1.1 trillion in a single year by mid-century.
Wow. That would be about double the defense budget now?
That's exactly right. And one of our greatest champions in the Congress, Senator Roy Blunt, often quotes that particular statistic to make the point to his colleagues and to the country that we have to act on this.
Harry, what are some of the early signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's? And a question I know that I think is on a lot of people's mind, how do you distinguish them from typical age-related change?
Well, certainly all of us as we age have the kinds of changes you're describing. It's not unlike the fact that we don't run as fast or do anything else perhaps as well as we once did. But those are natural and slower declines. For Alzheimer's and other causes of dementia, you wind up with what are more precipitous declines oftentimes. Now, some people do actually progress through the disease for as much as 20 years. But ultimately, while it starts maybe with a little memory loss, my mother had the disease. She couldn't, though she was a Depression-era girl, balance her checkbook, which she had done every week and couldn't do it anymore. Those are the first changes, but ultimately it progresses to simply not being able to swallow, not be able to walk. It is progressive and degenerative, and it is ultimately fatal, if not another cause of death first.
Yeah. Give me an example of a typical age-related change, because I think there are a lot of people who sometimes forget things and wonder, oh, my goodness, is this more serious than it really is? Could you sort of give us that distinction?
Well, certainly we all lose track of our keys, for example. I've done that my whole life. It's not simply just age-related, but the age kind of thing.
It's Harry-related.
There you go. Exactly. That's true. But the age thing, of course, can exacerbate those things. Again, at a at a lesser level. Mm-hmm. If you start to not know what your keys are for, then you're starting to cross into what would be dementia, Alzheimer's caused or otherwise. If, in fact, we can't find those keys, that's more likely the typical. Just slowing down on speed of processing, forgetting names.
Yeah.
Names are tough for everyone at any age, and those things will progress.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to not being able to do things you've previously been able to accomplish, then you're starting to cross over into dementia.
Gotcha. Are we able to diagnose Alzheimer's before its onset, and what are the benefits of that, if any?
Today we have, with the right tools in the hands of the right people, the ability to be 90-plus percent accurate with an Alzheimer's diagnosis for an individual. Now, not everyone everywhere has those right tools, and mm-hmm. they aren't necessarily those right hands. But if you get to a place that has trained neurologists, Alzheimer's Disease Center, those around the country, Alzheimer's Disease Research Centers, those individuals can make a pretty accurate diagnosis. Otherwise, the diagnosis, I'm afraid, is not so accurate. And in fact, too often, even when a doctor prescribes to the disease, doesn't still tell the family or the individual in about half the cases. So that's a major problem. The benefit in being detected, being diagnosed, is that even though we don't have treatments today that change the underlying course of disease, we know that the interventions we can help with at the Alzheimer's Association with care and support interventions, and that others can in local communities, those can make differences in the lives, the quality of lives for the people who have the disease and for the caregivers.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of myths that surround Alzheimer's, particularly as it relates to its causes, and I would suspect you've heard every single one of them. What are some of the more common myths that have you heard?
Well, you know, I think the most common one is that Alzheimer's is just a little memory loss,
mm-hmm.
That people think it's not going to be a very big effect, and we don't really have to pay attention to it, and we don't have to talk about it. We don't have to get detected or diagnosed. And that is a serious mistake because as the disease progresses, families don't know how to deal with it. So getting that diagnosis is really important to those ultimate outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Any others?
Well, certainly there are other kinds of things on the scientific side. For example, one of the most frequent questions I answer is about aluminum.
Yeah, sure.
Which,
I've heard that one.
Which, of course, I'm sure you have, and is
silver dental fillings and
these these kinds of things have been dismissed by science, but still they persist because they do remain available, of course, online and that sort of thing. So that's another kind of myth altogether. There are, as you said, many that persist about the disease. Certainly the idea that you've already asked the question about diagnosis, that you can't diagnose Alzheimer's until autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
There is perhaps a shred of truth in that in the sense that it's absolute then, of course. But even today, we now have made advances in science where we can get actual scans of the brain to determine the presence of the plaques you asked about. Those are available in the clinic. Now, they're not cheap, and they're not covered by insurance, so
uh-huh.
we have issues there.
Yeah, sure.
And for the tau, the tangles that you asked about, we have that in the lab, but not yet available to the public. But we're gaining on those fronts as well, and those are in live human brains
mm-hmm.
to see the actual pathology of Alzheimer's present in a live human.
Yeah, and another myth I've heard, too, is that only old people can get Alzheimer's. That would not be correct, would
well,
it?
Well, certainly it's true that the prevalence,
yeah.
the highest
mm-hmm.
incidence, is among those who are 65-plus. But there is especially a strain of the disease that is genetic. It's only about less than 1% of all incidence or prevalence. But for those individuals, if they get the gene mutation, they will get the disease.
Hmm.
And many of those families experience the disease certainly in their 50s, their 40s, even the 30s, and absolutely rarely in the 20s. So it certainly is true that younger onset Alzheimer's occurs also for people who don't have that genetic path, especially you'll see that more often in the 50s, and that is devastating as well, especially for people who still have children in school.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
These are not things people typically think of, as you say.
No, prime of life. Are there steps that an individual can take beyond the obvious of not smoking and exercising regularly to promote brain health?
You know, we just have emerging science. Within the past few years, a study done in Finland called the Finnish Geriatric Study that demonstrated the potential to do lifestyle interventions of those sorts so that if people do maintain better diet, exercise, as you said, engagement in community, potentially other kinds of brain activities, stimulation, education, that those kinds of things taken together proved, and it was a placebo-controlled trial, so gold standard trial, that suggested you can, in fact, change risk level by those kinds of effectively cardiovascular style management and interventions. We now have the evidence from the Sprint Mind trial announced just this past summer at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference that suggests, about to be published in a peer-reviewed medical journal, that in fact you can intervene on hypertension with a more aggressive approach to managing hypertension to 120 or below, and that the potential then is to actually eliminate perhaps as much as 1 in 5 occurrences of mild cognitive impairment, which are the precursor to full-blown dementia. That is a pretty exciting finding as well. So that would be a simple medical management comparatively of hypertension along with the lifestyle approaches.
Yeah. Let me ask you about brain training games, crossword puzzles, learning a foreign language. I read contradictory things about that. What's your take on all those things?
Well, the science is mixed, and there have been a couple of panels that have suggested at a meta level of analysis that not all of these things can yet be promoted as absolute ways to risk reduce, but there is mounting evidence that those kinds of things make a difference. We know that community engagement makes a difference for
socialization.
People. Socialization. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Even who already have the symptoms of the disease. We know that, in fact, there is evidence that people who have learned many languages seem to have some protection. Education may be protective, but some researchers believe quite strongly it isn't so much education in total, but early education access, and that can make a huge difference as well.
You know, being a caretaker for anyone with a serious chronic disease is a huge challenge, and I really can't imagine anything much more difficult than taking care of someone with Alzheimer's. What advice do you have for those caretakers, for those family members, and what things does the Alzheimer's Association do to help support them?
Well, we work with people who provide care in homes and across the country and communities every day through our 800 number, 800-272-3900, through ALZ.org. Those are places where people can come 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, talk to a live human being who's a trained social worker who those folks have talked people all the way to the point of out of murder-suicide because of the challenges that come with this, and certainly lots of information on the website as well to help navigate this. Taking care of themselves is the first order of business. It's not unlike when the flight attendant tells you to put that mask on first, because then you're going to save the people around you by putting theirs on. It's the same idea. If you can't take care of yourself, you won't be able to take care of others.
And that can be hard to do, I'm sure.
It's very challenging. My own mother has had this disease. My wife's mother, I've seen it up close and personal. It's challenging, and I've seen too many caregivers themselves succumb to illness, stress, depression. We know that those things happen frequently for caregivers, so it's so important for them to take care of themselves and turn to the Alzheimer's Association or elsewhere for the kind of help and support we and others can provide.
Yeah, well, I had the great pleasure when I was out at your offices of meeting some of the people in the call center, and I've had some friends who have called it, and it is absolutely fantastic, the job that they do. The Alzheimer's Association is the world's largest nonprofit funder for Alzheimer's research, and I know how difficult it's been to really get the breakthroughs we've all been hoping for. How do you go about funding this research, and do you believe there's some things out there right now that hold particular promise?
Well, we certainly work hard to fund this. There are many generous individuals as donors who help us make that happen. There are people, of course, who participate in walks and other activities across the country. All of our donors, in some way or another, make it possible to be the largest funder. I'm proud to say, too, Thomson Reuters says we're the highest impact funder, not only in the nonprofit space, but third only behind the U.S. federal government and the Chinese government in overall impact. So I do believe that we, in fact, are making great progress. We do run that largest science meeting in the world every summer. And at that one this year, we had some real advances in drug development, as well as this hypertension trial I mentioned. The advances are coming, and ever faster, because the federal government has increased what it funds. We've worked on that hard. They're doing that. That's making a big difference. The research community is more upbeat than I have ever seen them. I've been involved in the Alzheimer's world now over 13 years, and the whole community believes that we're on a path now to seeing advances that will lead us ultimately to what is the 2025 objective in the plan for the United States, which is prevention and effective treatment, so that we are on that course, I believe.
Yeah, and one of the things that's accelerating that course, and one of your core tenets, is sharing research data. Why is that so important, and what do you do to promote it?
Regrettably, across all of medical research, data are not shared as much as most likely people believe they are. Some of the very prizes that people hear about that have the greatest recognition, too often, I'm afraid to say, actually lead to people retaining data for achieving those kinds of outcomes. And actually, IP departments at universities are so protective. It's hard to get things leveraged out and into wider use. Some of these things are real impediments to the advancements of research. So the very meeting that I've mentioned is in no small part aimed at sharing those data.
Mm-hmm.
And we work on a project called GAIN, the Global Alzheimer's Association Interactive Network. It's a cloud network available to anyone, anywhere. All the tools are in the cloud, so you don't have to have local computing power, so that anyone around the world can access data that we continue to populate into that space.
Mm-hmm.
We're working with many others across the world on data sharing so that people have the best access in the research community to what's already been done. We don't have the money to replicate those things unnecessarily, and learning from each other can advance things very swiftly. We've seen that already happen in the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, where it's shared many, many more advances as a result.
Mm-hmm. You touched on this a moment ago, but let's talk a little bit more about public policy. And through your relentless efforts and others, in 2010, the National Alzheimer's Act was passed, and I think it was enacted into law the following year. What did this call for?
That act actually called for the creation of the plan I mentioned a few moments ago.
Mm-hmm.
We did not have a plan in the United States for all of the impact we talked about early on, all the numbers of people, all the costs, all the human impact of the disease. So now we do have such a plan, and that plan has now led to other advances as a result. So that the Congress has been motivated to act as a result of the plan that they actually asked to be created. So credit to them for that.
Right. And that led to, I guess, about 4 years later, the Alzheimer's Accountability Act.
That's right. The Alzheimer's Accountability Act, the Alzheimer's Association worked with leading members of Congress to create, have filed, and ultimately passed. And it takes it up a level to having the scientists at the National Institutes of Health actually tell the Congress how much additional money is needed in each coming annual appropriation to be able to reach that 2025 objective. And the Congress has responded to that with significant increases over the past several years.
What was your increase this past year?
This past year was $425 million added to the base, and that was on top of $414, $400, and $350 before those. So that adds up to now about $2.3 to $2.4 billion being spent annually. That's crucial because we know in cancer we've come to the point where about two-thirds of cancer patients can be cured, and we've been spending about $6 billion a year on cancer every year to make that happen. It's not cheap, but it's far cheaper than the costs of the disease that we talked about before, and certainly it diminishes so much of that human effect. There are huge returns in making those investments. And the Congress, credit to them, has stepped up on that on a bipartisan basis when other things haven't been moving.
Yeah, you're one of the few exceptions when I hear the word bipartisan basis. Harry, how do you balance funding priorities? And I know this can be an issue of discord in many national health organizations, as it has been in yours, and that is the urgency to fund research and impact public policy on one hand, and then supporting patients and families struggling with this disease right now on the other. How do you bring those together?
Balancing those kinds of strategies are always tough. I worked in cancer for many years, tough there, tough here in Alzheimer's. But we make those choices on the very core of the mission of the organization, from those origins we talked about earlier, where the people came together to do care and support and research. And so we do care and support in communities on that 800 number, on that website every day for millions of people, ultimately annually. And we aim to then also have the federal government do what they need to do, the state governments do what they need to do, private organizations do things that can occur for betterment of care, and then to drive the research that we fund. It's so important for the Alzheimer's Association to directly fund research. Because I always joke, and even with my friends in the federal government who we work with closely, we're faster than they are. So we are, and we can this advance things by years, by getting things started. That's why we have to do the research, even as we increase those federal dollars, because we seed fund, we speed funding, and then the federal government can scale the funding to the outcome. So critical that we balance those efforts, because until we can get all those answers through research, too many people are affected today in the care needs and the families who are carrying their own needs as well.
Yeah, that's very smart how you complement those two things, because as ironic as it may sound, nonprofit organizations actually can encounter failure and take risk more easily than the federal government. They have to go through their system, and they tend to fund very conservatively. And breakthroughs are sometimes not from conservative strategies or for people willing to roll the dice a little bit on something that and you guys are doing that.
No, you are absolutely right. And we have taken that position for years in the research we fund. In fact, the entire research community now believes that we should intervene sooner. Mm-hmm. And that is because we funded something no one else would fund, which was the identification of those plaques in the brain that you asked about with a radio tracer. And what that ultimately helped the whole field determine is that those plaques are present as much as 20 years in advance of the symptoms. And thusly, the consensus is we now must intervene sooner. So the risk reduction we've talked about, the potential of lifestyle intervention that can make a difference, and even utilizing the drugs that are in the pipeline, potentially ultimately not unlike a statin for cardiovascular disease, is now a course that we're on that we were not before. So taking those risks are crucially important, even as we increase the federal funding, because, as you say, they are constrained by certain conservative approaches that will never allow them to take the kinds of risks that we can do and make a difference with.
Absolutely. Well, let me close with this, Harry. You know, one of the biggest single drivers of public policy around an issue is getting people to talk about it. And my goodness, I can remember a time when cancer in this country was never discussed. As a matter of fact, when I was younger, it wasn't even uttered. It was called the Big C.
That's right.
And most doctors would, if they diagnosed someone with cancer, would never even tell them or their family. You have done a lot in getting more people to talk about Alzheimer's and dementia. But a lot more has to be done to have open and candid conversation. What can we do? What can you do to see that this, in fact, happens?
Well, you are certainly making a difference simply by having this conversation, which I deeply appreciate. And all of your colleagues in the media who do that make a real difference by raising the attention to the disease. And certainly, I will ask everyone who hears this to do the same. Mm-hmm. Talk about it. Simply talking about these things, as you suggest, can make a difference in what are the outcomes. It was true that at one point, not that long ago, 9 out of 10 doctors did not tell their patient when they had cancer diagnosis. And that changed, and when it changed, the pathway to the outcomes changed. That is, when people started talking about it more widely, then funding occurred. Activity occurred that drove research, detection, diagnosis occurred. All those things can change. And this very conversation, conversations people can have in the community, can change that every day. So I'll ask everyone to do that. You can be assured we will continue to do it. We'll continue to work on that. We're working on some things that will be campaigns you'll see in the future right now, not ready to release, that will ask people to talk about it even in families.
Mm-hmm.
Because too little is done even at home when there is recognition there's a problem. That alone can make a difference. So talk about it at home, talk about it in public, and you'll help us drive to the point where we'll realize the vision of the Alzheimer's Association, which is a world without Alzheimer's.
Well, fantastic. Well, Harry Johns, the President and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, the kind of information you have on it, and how listeners can get involved and help support this work.
At alz.org, we have a breadth of information and depth of information about Alzheimer's, other causes of dementia, ways they can get involved. We've just gone through our walk season around the country. Thanks to everyone who's participated there. There are many ways to get engaged as a volunteer locally, so we encourage you to do that, encourage each individual to help in any way you can, help us, help others, and it will make a difference in these outcomes in the near term and in the long term.
Well, thanks, Harry. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.